civil war, I'll say in 60, 61. I have been a refugee twice. This is my third time, and United States is the third country that has become my home now. I was a refugee in my childhood when the first civil war of Sudan started. My parents took refuge with me to Uganda. We were observed in by the indigenous, by the people of Uganda. By then, there was no refugee camps. Mm-hmm. I started my primary school in northern Uganda. And in 1972, when first Addis Ababa Agreement was signed, my parents got repatriated back.
You're talking about Anyanya 1.
Yes, Anyanya 1. Thank you.
Joseph Lagu.
Yes. You know it is so very well. In fact, Joseph Lagu is my cousin brother, too, just to be clear.
Interesting.
So, when we came back from exile, I continued to go to school 10 years after the second Anyanya 2 war broke out. I got displaced from Juba to Khartoum. Khartoum became my second home for 8 years. The situation was not getting better. I couldn't go back to Juba. I couldn't stay in Khartoum. So I had to migrate from Khartoum to Kenya. And in Kenya, I was an urban refugee. I was in Kenya for 3 years. In 1999, on June the 3rd, God opened the way for me to come to the United States with my family. Mm-hmm. So I have been, my entire life, I've been a refugee. And that is one of the most and the biggest reason why I started Nile Sisters, because I know the challenges of refugees, and especially African women refugees face. So that's how I started Nile Sisters, first to help women, but now we are not only serving women, we are serving women and men. Just like a man is the head of the house, but a woman is the neck of the house. Without the neck, the head is not strong. So we support women, we are supporting men. Thank you.
Walk us through, if you could, through a day in the life of a typical African refugee. For example, what time do you go to bed? Do you have a bed anyway? How many meals do you get a day? And what time do you wake up? No matter where you actually live or call a bed.
Yes, the typical refugee life, if not supported, is stressful. Beginning with navigating the system, where to get food. Now, where to get food using public transport to go to grocery store or shopping. Back home where I came from, you can walk, you can use bicycle. If you want to go far, you can use buses or matatu.
But you have to have that money, you have to have transport.
Yes.
Where do you get that money from?
It is difficult. In my experience, when I first got here, I did not have a dime. And I did not know how to use public transport. The difference between the public transport service here and back home is in public transport, in buses, matatu, there is a bus conductor. When you enter in a bus, the conductor will come and collect money from you. But here in the United States, there is no conductor. There is a driver. There is a little box next to driver, which doesn't talk to you. Nobody tells you what to do when you enter in a bus. And that box there doesn't give you a change. You have to know the right amount. You have to know the right place where you can insert your money and you go to sit. So it is a challenge. When a refugee enters in a bus, there must be somebody who needs to educate them how to use the bus service. You have to have either $1.75 or $2.50 and insert it in the right box. Don't expect a change back. That is education. As a result, to address that, now Nile Sisters is working with a governmental agency called SANDAC here in San Diego. We train, educate, and help refugees to understand the bus services, and not only bus, but other different transportation services like Uber, like carpooling, like using vouchers, and transportation for seniors. So that is addressing transportation services. How about food? To get healthy food, most of refugees are resettled in low-income places and in food desert areas. How do you get nutritive and healthy food? What is the value of eating salad? Is a new thing. Some of our people call salad grass. They, I'm not a good to eat fresh leaf. I need to cook. So we educate them on nutrition and food choices, reading food labels. Don't buy expired food. Don't buy fatty food. When you cook chicken or beef, trim off the fat that you can see, the skin. All this is educational for refugees. And another thing is sugary food, like cake, sodas, and juices. This is in plenty in low-income areas. So because it is also very cheap. So it is the most thing that, you know, when mothers go to store, they buy big cake, they buy sodas and put it there for. And it affects their health. Diabetes has become prevalent. Obesity has become prevalent. So we are educating our population on the importance of doing exercise. Eat well, exercise. Back home, nobody talks about exercise.
Well, because a lot of time... You spend the day walking.
Yes, definitely. They spend time walking. Everything you want to do is you walk, you sweat. So whatever food you eat, you sweat it out, you walk it away. But here, it is different. They think it is luxury if you are able to eat sweet things, the cookies there on the table, cake, sodas, and it is different. So we have to educate them on healthy eating, healthy habits. You have to go and walk. It is not luxury. You have to walk. So that is a typical refugee's life. They spend a lot of times idle if they are not working at home, and their lifestyle has changed. But Nile Sisters is making a huge difference in educating them and supporting them to get on the right track, be healthy. And we motivate them to the extent we go to canyons, to clean canyons, to clean the street, and to make them socialize and get together to share their experiences.
Interesting.
That's something that we help also building their mental stage for healthy life and being productive citizens of this country. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Iskinda, when you talk about Africa, you said that the fundamental root causes of the refugee exodus is largely because of conflicts. How do we eliminate these conflicts and bring about good governance so that people do not really have to run away from their home? Because let's be honest, there is a saying that there is more than enough for all of us, except for the greed. How do we eliminate this greed business so that our people can live in their God-given paradises, really? When you talk about Africa, some people might get a false sense that Africa is poor. On the contrary, you and I know that Africa is arguably one of the wealthiest continent on this planet Earth. And yet, Africans are the poorest on this planet Earth. How do we somehow work out a way of empowering our people, of restoring our people's dignity, so that they do not become beggars, they do not start running around the world for a living?
Great question, as always, Shaka. Let me just add a few things to Al Zawit's organization work. I think the Nile Sisters do a great job in providing those critical services. Just for our audience, there are over 1,000 organizations in the U.S. Serving refugees. Some of them are African organizations like the Nine Sisters. There are other organizations have been providing services to refugees. My organization has been providing those services since 1911. Actually, this is 110 years anniversary of our organization, not just African refugees, you know, Eastern European refugees. In the U.S., we have...
Let me take this opportunity to congratulate you on that.
Thank you. So the U.S. has a very good refugee resettlement system. The government is involved. The Congress, on a yearly basis, appropriate millions of dollars to support refugees. When refugees are coming to this country, there is a system. That system actually treats them like any other American citizen who really needs some social services, whether it's food stamp, whether it's housing assistant. There are probably 220 different refugee resettlement sites in the U.S. When refugees are coming, there is somebody already assigned. They go pick them up at the airport, find them housing, provide them orientation. So it is a public partnership system. But one thing is that we have a system in every state and every county where refugees can access services. Elizabeth is right. You know, the transition from coming for a refugee camp to the U.S., for some of them, as you know, they were born and raised in refugee camps, so their exposure is very, very limited. So it's going to take time, you know, whether it's a bus service, whether it's law enforcement issue, whether they're getting English as a second language, all of that is going to take time. But overall, African refugees and other refugees actually succeeded in this country enormously in every aspect of the U.S. life, you know. In fact, unlike other refugees who came into this country before, we have now well-distinguished leaders in Congress who came in as refugees. So there is a lot of that refugees are doing in this country. They're contributing to the community. They're part of the community. But having said that, like any transition coming to a new country, a new language, a new culture, a new community, it's going to take some adjustment, and that integration process will take time. And as the Nile Sister has been doing for, you know, since their inception, that supplemental service is going to be very, very crucial as we go forward to make sure that refugees are succeeding, not staying in the government support for a long period of time. So I just wanted just to give you that the U.S. perspective, because Elizabeth was talking on the local California San Diego issue, but I wanted to give you the overall U.S. resettlement
Just staying in the U.S. very briefly, Iskender, if you don't mind, how does an average African refugee, for example, qualify for the refugee resettlement to the United States?
Yeah, that's a very good country. As I said, you know, we have about 26 plus million refugees. So the U.S. probably, and then other countries like Canada and Australia do take some refugees. So the process is when the refugees are going to a refugee camp, let's say from South Sudan to Uganda, they will be registered by the UN organization called the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Once their refugee status is determined in Uganda, then you know the UNHCR could refer some of them for resettlement, and sometimes for U.S., sometimes for Canada or Australia or other countries. So that's really how the system is, a referral system. Refugees will be asking, and then UNHCR will examine case by case and make a determination. I keep in mind, the average refugee staying refugee come at least 17 years. And then, as I said before, we have still protracted refugee situation since 1991 in Somalia, since 1968, Eritrean refugees in Sudan, and then you have Sahrawi refugees since 1975. And, you know, the growing number that has been in Africa for a long period of time. So not all refugees get a chance, to select few get a chance to be resettled in the U.S. So every time there is a new government coming in, they model their governance style based on that cultural, governance they learned from the colonial power. This may not be the only excuse, but I think as long as there is corruption, as long as there is a lack of democracy, lack of rights, I think the issue of refugees and crisis in Africa will continue. Africa actually invests more in military hardware than in education or healthcare system. That tells you that our priority has been completely misplaced. And then, you know, we are not the only one. You know, the people who are actually providing us sometimes is rather than books, they give us military hardware. So we use that military hardware very much to displace our own people, to oppress our own people.
Iskender, if you could help us, you definitely occupy a very significant position. You've been a refugee yourself, and you now head one of the most important refugee institutions in the world. If you were to look in that camera, supposing some of the African leaders were watching or listening to this program, what would you say to them that they really need to do in order to help their people regain their God-given dignity of staying at home in the land of their ancestors?
That's a very challenging question, but I'll try. I think what I will say to the African leaders, the current leaders, if they are leaders, because I think it's very difficult for me to to call them leaders, because to lead, you know, you have to be, you have to serve.
Correct.
So the mindset is they believe that these leaders, the people are supposed to serve them rather than the leader serving the people.
So you're talking about rulers, perhaps.
Exactly. We have rulers, not really leaders, you know, that they don't have a vision for the people. They don't want to listen to the people. They always have this fake election they do. I mean, you know what, every time we have election, you know, how many people died in Africa because of the controversy in election.
They call them, yeah. They conveniently refer to them as holding periodic elections.
Yes. Yeah, so I think, you know, we need a servant leadership in Africa rather than, you know, leaders wants to be served by the people. That has to change. I think we need to expand the civil society. Without the civil society, you know, the government's very much role without any check and balance. I think we need, you know, the African, based on our culture and history, a democratic transition. I think the diaspora or the intellectual, the elite class, who sometimes are also aiding and abetting the system, needs to do some self-examination. You know, as you said, Africa is rich, we have resources, but if we don't know how to manage what you have, it's barren, you know, it has no value. So I think it's very, very important for African leaders and African intellectuals to ask the question, how long are we going to be enduring this crisis? How many years can we be a recipient of foreign aid when we have plenty in our own country? I think that the international community also need to think, you know, Africa should not be in a position to be ruled or by foreign aid rather than by supporting Africans, you know, to support themselves. So there's a lot I can say, but at the end of the day, I think we need servant leaders in Africa. Until we get them, we have this fake election we do every 4 years, sometimes every five years. And then we create this system. I mean, somebody has been in a position for 35 years, you know, it creates its own class of people. So they don't want to give up. So that's part of the challenge we have. You know, we need to have a term limit. They keep changing the constitution every time they want to stay in power. And we have seen it, you know, from North Africa all the way Central and West Africa and East Africa now. So I think we need to take an example of the South Africa, the newest country. You know, in such a short period of time, they had election and they have actually chosen different people to take them to the next level, given all the crisis and what they inherited. So I think that's going to be my message. But I think the message is also for our people. We shouldn't accept the status quo. I understand, you know, these leaders have military behind them. They have tanks and jets. But at the same time, we have to say enough is enough. We can't go on like this. And we want to make, you know, our continent a better place for its people.
You said that when it comes to power, the oppressor does not cede power easily. What you can do perhaps is demand it or take it. And in order for you to do that, you have to organize, not agonize, but organize and mobilize.
Yes, yeah. You're right.
In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, let's keep the African hopes alive.